Hello, everyone. My name is Tanishtha Pramanik, and I am here with the CIC for our podcast, Plan C. I know it's been a while since our last episode, but I'm so excited to start our second season and want to thank our listeners for joining us as we record here today in Boston. I would like to introduce and thank our guest today, Dr. Maria Robson-Morrow. Maria manages the Intelligence Project at Harvard's Belfer Center for Science and International Affairs. She also teaches occasional graduate-level intelligence analysis courses at Johns Hopkins University. Maria previously worked at Nexen Energy in Calgary as a global security intelligence analyst and then ran her own security intelligence consulting firm. She holds a PhD in political science from Northeastern University, a master's from the University of Calgary's Center for Military and Strategic Studies, and a BA from the University of Toronto. Maria's research focuses on the professionalization of private sector intelligence, how governments and companies share intelligence, and the role of security intelligence in contemporary business. Her work has been published in peer-reviewed academic journals and the business press, including Intelligence and National Security, The Cipher Brief, and the Harvard Business Review. Let's get started.
To start, do you think you could tell our listeners more about the field of private sector intelligence, kind of what is it and what is it that you do in it?
Absolutely. Thank you so much. And to begin with, I'm really excited to have been asked to talk about this on Plan C because private sector intelligence is so infrequently discussed and really delved into in detail. And that's part of what drew me to this field. I'm happy to talk about that more. But really, to start us off with what it is, it involves the legal and ethical application of intelligence techniques that we might be familiar with from CIA, CSIS, other entities, but really legally, ethically using open source in the private sector. So for companies to mitigate security and geopolitical risks. So it's ultimately mitigating risk and facilitating decision-making in those companies. And I thought I might illustrate this with a story, if that's all right by you. It goes back to, now I research this field, but I used to work in this field. So it goes back to in 2015 in Nigeria, there were elections, national elections scheduled for February that were pushed to March because of concerns about the security environment of tensions in the country, memories of the previous elections. And my role in this was that we had people in the country. I was working for a Canadian energy company that had people on the ground in Lagos. And so we were asking, we remembered what had happened in the previous elections where there was violence in the streets. And so we were asking, what are the trends here? What is the likelihood of violence that could affect our employees and assets and operations in Nigeria this time around? So this was the key driver, was this protection of people and assets, mitigating risk and anticipating in advance. So this planning, these discussions happened many weeks before the elections were scheduled to take place. The way that we tried to answer these questions were by using a multitude of different sources. They're private intelligence vendors who were sending us reporting. We were reaching out to them. We were also collecting their reports, their assessments of the situation. You can reach out to their analysts and ask questions in certain situations, things like that. That was one source. Certainly the media, international, but also local Nigerian news trying to get across that of how it was seen on the ground, perceptions and expectations on the ground and the facts on the ground. Then also security information from the Government of Canada for travelers, the State Department for travelers, the British travel advisories, again, a cross-section, getting different perspectives on risks to people in country at the time. And there were various other open sources. So you can look at social media reporting, for example, to try to get a holistic threat picture. And so all of that is open source, but the idea is getting this whole cross section of it. And so I share that story. Ultimately, it turned out that the 2015 elections were not like the previous elections. Unfortunately, there was limited violence and unrest, and it was a successful democratic outcome. But we had been asking questions such as, do we have our employees shelter in place? Do we evacuate expats? What do we say to our local employees and their families? How do we ensure that we're keeping them safe? Do we close the office leading up to the election or in the immediate aftermath of the election? Questions like that we were able to answer through proactive security intelligence analysis. So again, I use that story just to, in the hopes that it's a useful illustration of one of the many types of work that private sector intelligence analysts do.
I guess what I want to ask now is, you said that was in 2015. So how do you think private sector intelligence importance has changed? We're halfway through the 2020s. What do you think companies would want to prioritize today globally when utilizing this resource?
Absolutely. It's such a wonderful question. So since 2015, there have been a few fundamental shifts. One is that executives now rank geopolitical risk as one of their top three concerns. Mm-hmm. That's fairly consistent across recent polling, mm-hmm. and that marks quite a shift from a decade ago. And so a second shift, which really probably is driving the other one, is we've had several really high-profile crises that profoundly affected companies. So the COVID-19 pandemic was a key one, and then the Russian invasion of Ukraine in 2022 was another key event that really pushed the needle, and then the October 7 attacks and the aftermath of that also affected companies directly. All of these were a reminder to companies that they really need to be thinking about risk in a proactive way, and that has helped shift the landscape.
Like you're mentioning companies, so private sector companies seeking out these resources and these complex topics. I mean, the world is definitely crazier. What are some industries that I guess would seek out your resources? And like you mentioned, the pandemic and conflict in Ukraine, like what were some companies and fields that were like, okay, we need some help on this, figuring out what's going on?
Absolutely. So there are companies that, for whom it was a wake-up call that they needed help. There are also companies that are success stories because they were already using techniques. They were mm-hmm. already thinking about this. They already had intelligence teams that really shone in these crises. This function exists in any industry you and I can think of. It exists. Okay. In the banks, the airlines, the retail companies, companies that have a risk exposure, particularly overseas, are likely to have some form of this function. Now, we could talk about the different forms it takes, the effective and ineffective models, but really, if you and I were to start naming major Canadian companies, they probably have this function. Certainly major U.S. firms do. So going back to the Russia-Ukraine example, there were certain firms that were really proactive. Just as an example, there are major food and beverage firms that had large risk exposure in Ukraine and Russia that had very proactive intelligence assessments where mm-hmm. those teams were going to their executives warning about the potential for Putin to initiate an invasion of mm-hmm. Ukraine, and that support was able to influence the outcomes. Companies that had large retail presences were very exposed, and some of them were proactive in that way. But another industry I really want to highlight is aviation. The passenger okay. airlines are incredible in this space. This includes all the airlines you can think of, American Airlines, Delta, United, Air Canada, WestJet. They're mm-hmm. all engaged in this. They have security intelligence capabilities to try to mitigate risk to their crews and passengers. We see it right now with the situation in the Middle East.
Yeah, they redivert the flight path.
Exactly. Yes. So that is a very proactive function where airlines are monitoring the risk constantly and making decisions that are going to mitigate the risk to their routes and their flights. So that industry is really, to me, a gold standard of what this can look like. But there are many.
So how did you become involved in this specifically? I mean, it's so fascinating, and I know the relevancy has really just gone up in this century, but what drew you to this? What made you want to pick this specifically when it comes to kind of this IR poli-sci kind of work?
I like this question because it really speaks to the fact that there are avenues and careers that we don't think about when we're students. And so I'm really mm-hmm. hopeful that I love talking to students about this. Students might identify private sector intelligence as a career path and also as a domain of scholarship, which I'm seeing more now. I'm seeing more students beginning to study intelligence, not just in the traditional government agency sense, mm-hmm. but also the bigger picture landscape. And they're not completely dichotomous. They actually interact a lot. I got into this through happenstance, which from my surveys of the field is the predominant way that people came into it. In my case, I was studying intelligence history and Canadian signals intelligence and wasn't really sure where I was going to go with that. And mm-hmm. then during my master's, I happened across this opportunity as an intern, as a summer student, to work at an energy company in corporate security. And it turned out, in that particular case, in that company, the head of the team had a very proactive intelligence-driven vision that meant that I was doing intelligence work. And that was hugely rewarding because, again, it was protecting people and assets. If we think back to the Nigeria case, that was one of a few instances in which it was life safety we were working on, and that was very rewarding. And so the next pivotal moment for me was in November 2013. So I began this work in May of 2012. And then the next year, my boss sent me to a meeting that was convened by the State Department down in Washington, D.C., and it was a meeting of the Overseas Security Advisory Council, which is a group that dates back to 1985 under Secretary of State George Shultz, and its mission is to support the private sector in overseas operations with a security mm-hmm. objective, so to protect assets operations people overseas for U.S. companies, or they've actually expanded to include companies that are incorporated in the U.S. So I was working for a Canadian company and I was able to be there. And what I realized there was, this is so much bigger than me, so much bigger than my company and my team. There is this community that is international of individuals who are looking at this risk mitigation, this security mission. And we all are facing similar concerns or challenges about the external perception of this and whether it is meeting its full potential, because there's so many different models and ways to approach these mm-hmm. similar questions. And if you're all doing it separately in silos, then it isn't going to be as effective as if there is benchmarking communication. And so this is what was happening at the practitioner level, but it was not really happening at the academic level at that time. So that was what really drove me a few years later when I decided to go back and do my PhD, was the idea of looking into this systematically, academically, realizing that people in the community wanted to be interviewed, they wanted to be better understood, they wanted their stories told. And happily now there are other researchers who are tackling this as well, and it's really exciting to see the body of knowledge develop.
I guess one thing I want to go back to is, we mentioned like kind of being siloed, not really integrating, and how academia is helping sort of bring people together. But there's other ways, I guess, companies are going to do risk assessment. There's due diligence, there's business intelligence, there's political risk teams. How do you think this specifically, what you do, is different from that? And also, how do you think it like contributes or kind of augments or interacts with, you know, these other ways?
So I hope academia is helping bring people together sometimes. I'm not sure whether we are or not, but certainly we're helping shed light in a way that's collaborative. So I mm-hmm. look at what I'm doing as I am still accepted by the community that I used to be part of as a practitioner, and I really hope that that is valuable for everyone. I'm really grateful for that. So as you mentioned, it's a very complex landscape. There are all these different business functions that have pieces of the risk puzzle or pieces of supporting business in different ways. So I want to draw a fundamental distinction between security or risk intelligence
okay.
and competitive intelligence or business intelligence or market okay. intelligence, which is really focused on the market, on what competitors are doing.
Right.
And so this function is really, how do you keep people safe, how do you protect assets? And then to some extent, opportunity analysis, and this is where there are a lot of internal debates in the community over whether it should be about facilitating business on the corporate strategy side, or whether
right.
it should be fundamentally about mitigating risk and really the security focus. So corporate security is very interesting, because often the intelligence function sits within corporate security. That's the most common model.
Mm-hmm.
When I surveyed this community and asked, where do you sit within the corporate organizational chart? Corporate security was the most common response. It was 23% of the time, but there were 20 different possible answers that came up. So it could be legal, it could be HR, it's all over the place. But often it's in security, or it started in security, because
okay.
security is recognized. So you and I were talking about this shift in mindset at the executive level when it comes to geopolitical risk.
Yes.
Security has been understood for a lot longer. So if we go back to the 1990s, and then particularly after 9/11, but even in the 1990s, there was this understanding of the need to have corporate security teams that would investigate security incidents, for example, when things went wrong, or even would look proactively at core security questions. And then building onto that was this idea of more proactive intelligence that had a broader remit and scope to mm-hmm. help mitigate risk.
So it's sort of, there were the typical, you know, due diligence, risk, and this kind of emerged as the thing that we need to really have.
There's so much variation in the
right.
different models and the structures. There are questions within companies about how the due diligence, risk compliance teams, risk management teams, ERM, how they work together with more of the security intelligence team or the risk intelligence team or the geopolitical intelligence team, depending on the terminology.
Right.
So there's really no one size fits all model. You see all sorts of different ones. When I surveyed the community in 2019, I asked, so it was the night before my survey was set to be disseminated, and I was thinking about it and realized, I haven't asked anybody what their job title is. How will I make sure that the people who answer the survey are actually meant to be part of the population I'm sampling
mm-hmm.
from? So I added this question of, what is your job title, which was just intended as a filter to ensure the respondents were actually in the community. And what happened was, I then tried to sort and count how many of each job title I'd come up with, and essentially nobody had given the same job title, which then I standardized down if it was something like security manager or manager, security, things like that, standardized down, and it was 72 different answers, which really reflects how varied and heterogeneous this landscape is and how there isn't one model that's been settled.
So that's just like super wide demand. It's kind of one thing that you're doing, but it serves so many different functions based on the needs of the client.
Yes, it can manifest in many different ways. And as you said, it's based off the needs of the client, but also it can be a reflection of the models that people who set up the teams experienced before. So 57% of practitioners in this space, when I was surveying it, and my understanding is it hasn't really changed that much, had a government background. So they'd worked at an intelligence agency and military and law enforcement. And so there are certain models that get brought into the private sector. And then there are others who have a corporate background who would bring a different vision into the private sector. And it gets even more nuanced than that. There's so many different models that can be based off the vision of the person who's building the team, the leaders who have empowered them to build the team, and then the needs of the company.
So it's really just like a layered, people coming in are diverse and the needs being met are diverse. Definitely. Going out. It's really...
And then you throw in a crisis that happens to the company or a peer company, and then that can change everything.
This extra excitement, just to be optimistic about what's going on at this point.
Well, crises actually sometimes prompt very positive change, so it's a silver lining of a very unfortunate situation.
I've been hoping that's the case with a lot of the things going on now, or else I don't really know.
Well, COVID-19 was such an example of that.
Game changer.
Yeah, some teams were cut with job cuts across the board, but others were actually empowered to do more.
To do more.
Because they were seen as teams that could help make sense of uncertainty. So really, going back to how we define this, really it's about making sense of uncertainty. And that's true of intelligence in the government side, but also the private sector side. And if you're seen as being able to do that, then you might be tapped for things like pandemics, which you weren't expecting to be doing.
So I guess my next question is, you know, we have national security agencies, all those three-letter, in Canada's case, CSIS, four-letter agencies. How does the work that is done in the private sector kind of differ from that? You know, how would you say it's sort of the same, but also how would you say, like, things are different, whether it's how you're collecting information or what needs you're prioritizing, so...
Yes, I love this question, because the answer is there are some key differences, which I'll talk about, but... there are some profound similarities in terms of the tradecraft, in terms of the intelligence cycle of collection, analysis, dissemination. All that is very similar, even though it might be just one poor person tackling all aspects of the cycle at a company.
Okay.
Because these teams can be quite lean, quite small. And just in terms of the similarities, before I get to the differences, I was talking to a colleague who had worked at an intelligence agency, and I was telling him about the 2014 invasion of Sana'a by the Houthis in Yemen, which now the Houthis are a household name because of the Red Sea shipping, but they were not in 2014, which was when I was working on them for the company I was at. And so I was describing to him 2014 into 2015 when it was the beginning of the coalition airstrikes and the conflict began in Yemen, and we had people on the ground who had to be evacuated. And as I was talking about it, he said to me, "This sounds exactly like what we would do on the government side." And so that was an interesting moment for both of us, of realizing this is not so different when it comes to life safety within a conflict situation that's emerging, and the questions you're asking and then the decisions you have to make. Now, some of the questions, some of the decisions are fundamentally different if it's a government versus a private company. Mm-hmm. But there were some parallels, including in how we were getting information. But then this takes me to the differences, where there are three really profound types of differences. There's a difference in the type of information you can access. So if you're working...
I was just about to ask,
yes,
like security clearance,
classified information.
Who you have getting your information,
The caveat on that is that you can have a clearance in the private sector.
Oh, okay.
And so some people do, either they bring it over from the government or they're sponsored because they're part of a critical infrastructure sector, so they're sponsored by the government. So that can happen. However, I would say the majority of practitioners in the private sector get all the information they need to do their jobs through open sources and don't have that need for a clearance. That's one aspect. The other part and parcel of that is you can't run clandestine. So there's a difference in access to information. There's a difference in resourcing. These intel teams when I was doing my survey research, a lot of the teams had, say, two people on them. Some of them are larger, especially in certain sectors. Mm-hmm. Some of them are very small. Some of them have a dual mission. A lot of the team is focused really on corporate security, then tapped a little bit for intelligence questions. But a key difference compared to an intel agency is that the intel agencies might have individuals who work on really specific subsets of an issue in a country. So I've talked to people who used to look at drug trafficking in Latin America in particular countries. And so there were lots of other security issues in those countries or political issues that were nothing to do with them. They were really just focused on this one issue. Whereas if you're working for, say, a Canadian bank that has operations in Latin America, you could be concerned about drug trafficking, you're concerned about criminality, you're concerned about political stability. There are all these different questions, and they're all on you. And you're probably looking at Colombia, Brazil, Paraguay, all of them at the same time. So that's a profound difference. It's very common to have analysts who divide up the world. So you have someone for Latin America, someone for Africa or West Africa.
Specialization really in regions.
Yes, Asia Pacific. I knew one poor soul, bless her, who, when Russia invaded Ukraine, was responsible for all of Europe and all of Africa. And Russia and Ukraine was not the only issue going on at that time. So that is a profound difference. And then the third and final difference I wanted to mention is just the legal parameters are quite different if you're public versus private.
So that brings me to my next question, actually. I think earlier on we brought up, like, there's business intelligence, which kind of has a different focus than, you know, what private security intelligence would want to emphasize. I mean, how does private sector intelligence, you know, carry out its work in an ethical manner? Because I know from my experience working in healthcare, sometimes there's been, you know, we have private healthcare in the U.S., so it's sort of like, what's going to make this business operate at its best? You know, you have shareholders versus what's going to be, like, the outcomes of, like, the patients we're serving. And you want them both to align, but sometimes they just don't, so.
Absolutely. It's a really good question. So there are a couple different aspects to it. One, the alignment and what is driving you. So many of the practitioners in this field are driven by the national security mission. And so many of them, as we talked about, have worked in the government, moved to the private sector, but still are interested in furthering security, protecting human lives. And so that's fundamentally different from being driven by the bottom line and the core mission, even though you really have to understand the needs of the business in order to be useful and to be valuable and helpful. So that can be a bit of a mindset challenge. In terms of the ethical code, I have a good friend and fellow researcher, Louis Sage Passant, who has his PhD from the University of Loughborough in the UK, focused on this field on private sector intelligence, and he has done a bit of work on ethical codes, and what he found surveying the community was individuals couldn't point to a particular code of ethics that was driving them in their work, but sometimes they would point to the corporate code of ethics or company culture. There is an association of private sector intelligence professionals, it's called AREP, which has a code of conduct, so this does exist, and yet what he found was that this type of professional code is not the go-to at this point in the early professionalization process for this field. Maybe it will be one day.
Okay.
But at this point, it's really these individual, either some people are focusing on their own values as their driver, or corporate codes of ethics. And then the other phenomenon that I've seen is, in this community, reputations are key. The idea that you might be ostracized from a group that you depend on to share information.
You lose your source and you lose that relationship.
Exactly. Yeah. So reputations and relationships really, I think, are a driver. And I wanted to share a cautionary tale. So we talked about the business versus security mindset, but there's also the transgressing on the ethical side, including delving into that illegal or illicit behavior we talked about that might be justifiable for a national intelligence agency on national security grants, but it's not justifiable in the private sector. In 2019, the security team at eBay got in trouble, and they've now been charged. People have been fired. There have been fines. The Department of Justice indicted people over this. So, so brace yourself. Here's the story. And there's a big New York Times piece on this, and it's in other media outlets as well. The security team began harassing a couple who I believe were here in Massachusetts, and they were sending them They sent them a box of cockroaches.
Oh my gosh.
They sent them harassing reading material. They were outside their house in a van.
Sounds like a bad breakup more than anything else.
It's really, really unfortunate what happened here, and really as though it's out of the movies.
Yeah.
And so this is a cautionary tale in the community, because it was a team that was led by an individual who really developed this cult of personality and this idea of we are spooky and mysterious, and this is justified for the company, for the good of the company. The background here was that the couple had written things that were critical.
And this was
of
for eBay. Their,
yes.
Okay.
This is within eBay. So the New York Times also talks about an analyst on that team who was quite junior, who felt caught up in this and was asking herself whether or not this was appropriate behavior, but really had no recourse. And this goes back to the lack of a legal or ethical code.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly legal reasons. Some of this did end up crossing a serious line, and that's why the Department of Justice got involved. But this was a cautionary tale of the need to avoid any sense of being spooky security people and instead really behaving in a legal and ethical and transparent professional way. Exactly.
No, I mean, I guess it's kind of clear now how important it is that you have something, even if it's not standardized, it's client and context specific. Like, you can't be sending people boxes of bugs. Like, that's just, not it.
And that
that's
one really does cross a legal line, so that becomes much clearer. But absolutely, it's helpful to have a recourse. It's helpful to have standards to point to in cases where it might be more murky.
You know, we are with the Canadian International Council, and we try and spotlight, you know, global issues, Canadian perspectives. What is something you'd say is unique or more emphasized in terms of private sector security needs with Canadian companies? Like, is there something unique to us? Is there some issue right now in the world that might be more pertinent? Like, what are some specific things, you know, our companies need to be keeping an eye out for, already more important?
Yeah, absolutely. So there are some threats that are transnational that are affecting Canadian and American companies. And so those teams talk to each other and try to understand the landscape together. So the situation in the Middle East affects everyone.
Yep.
There are repercussions of it that affect even companies that do not have a physical presence or even travelers to the Middle East because of, as we've seen, the protest activity that can be legal, or it can cross over into instances of violence. And so there's always this idea of not wanting to have your personnel in the wrong place at the wrong time.
Mm-hmm.
So those types of geopolitical threats, current crises, are important for any company to be keeping their eye on, to understand the ramifications for them. For Canadian companies, there is a bit of a contrast in the internal structure of the intelligence teams, where I've seen a lot of benchmarking, a lot of comparisons of structures within Canadian companies. So they have a slightly different model often than the U.S. companies, although there's a lot of transnational learning as well. But a few different trends when it comes to Canada. But thinking about the risks that are being faced, a major risk that is more and more, I think, on the radar is IP theft, is intellectual property theft,
okay,
or corporate espionage. It's certainly not a new phenomenon, but there's a bit more focus.
Tech more than
tech? Tech, but other sectors, universities certainly are facing this.
Okay, yeah, the research there, yeah.
Yes, so I think there's more awareness and more of a focus on that as a pressing issue now for Canadian entities that should be on the radar. And then there are perpetual concerns, like executive protection concerns, that I think are always an issue, particularly if companies are weighing in on divisive current events, political issues, then their executives or even their families might be targeted. So
right, protection,
to be concerned about. Yeah.
So that brings me to another question. I mean, the universities in Canada, most of them are like public institutions, but they wouldn't rely maybe at all on CSIS? Like, they would have their own...
They would have their own capacity to understand the threat landscape. So that's true here as well. There are some very sophisticated teams at the universities who are dealing not just with threats to that research and development might be a target for espionage, but also travelers, students studying abroad. There are all sorts of programs in place to support them.
Right, to decide whether you're still going to have the study abroad this year or not, if you're going to, you know, have the send people to the conference or not.
Absolutely. And This is a whole other discussion, but when it comes to faculty, there are often very limited parameters on what can or can't be permitted, as opposed to students where there are more restrictions that can be put in place.
I guess I have one more question. Thank you so much for this. You've made this job sound really cool, and I don't mean like you've made it sound cool, but it's not. I mean, it's genuinely interesting. I'm sure we have some of our listeners being like, how do I do this? How do I get into this? Could you give some pointers for them if they're interested?
Absolutely.
I mean, I'm interested at this point, so.
Well, I'm glad to hear that. I don't want to oversell it. I loved working in that space.
Yeah.
But I know that my friends in the community would want to make sure that we're realistic about the fact that there are all sorts of frustrations that come along with the, as I mentioned, the nascent professionalization here, where
we're still very early, kind of
different job titles, different team structures. A lot of it is driven by individual personalities or by crises.
Mm-hmm.
So the pendulum can really swing from a team that's valued and effective to suddenly one that feels that it's not being tapped to its full potential. So there are challenges, as there are in any corporate job. There are many different challenges you can run into, but it is a special community, a special line of work that I found very, very rewarding. So in terms of students looking to enter this space, I would say it is much better to try to do it in 2024 than it was a decade earlier. There was a real focus in the early 2000s in particular on having a government background, and now
mm-hmm.
there's a real focus on more diverse teams that
okay.
have many different backgrounds, perspectives, skills that people are bringing to the table, instead of having a cookie cutter approach where everyone has come from the same
right,
government
so you
agency.
Could come from your area
better.
Of specialization. So
exactly. So it's really valuable to have language skills, to have some sort of regional skills. Students who have an opportunity to study abroad
mm-hmm.
or be exposed to a different culture, always helpful. Having technical skills, data analytical skills are useful as well. Increasingly, I think AI literacy is going to be important in this area too. But ultimately, a lot of it comes back to critical thinking, reading, writing, being able to engage and understand people, being able to brief people. I have another good colleague and friend in this space, Angela Lewis, who also did her PhD on private sector intelligence. She teaches at Georgetown now and works in the private sector,
mm-hmm.
and she has written about critical thinking and these analytical skills that never go away. Students
right,
who,
they're just core.
Exactly. They show that they can write, they can synthesize large quantities of information in a digestible way, and they can engage people and understand them. It's really, it goes back to that human intelligence
mm-hmm.
idea of really understanding, being interested in people, and being able to engage with stakeholders, which then allows you to support
like systems of people
exactly.
within the situation. It's not like a hard and fast binary, this or that. It's a lot of critical thinking, contextual thinking.
Absolutely.
I just want to thank you. You know, this has been great. It's something that doesn't really get a lot of attention. I mean, I definitely remember when I was in university, geopolitical risk kind of came across as like, well, you're going to like invest in something somewhere else, but if the infrastructure gets destroyed, is that a good or bad idea? But it's clearly so much more than that. And Maria, I just want to thank you so much. We really appreciate it here at the CIC, and this has been great.
It's Thank
been
you
awesome.
So much to you and to your colleagues at CIC for having me. I've really
of
enjoyed
course.
The conversation.
It's always awesome to highlight cool Canadians doing stuff wherever we are, which is right now Boston, but still.
It's always a pleasure to meet other Canadians in Boston.
Thank you so much for tuning in today. And of course, if you have any questions or suggestions, you can always drop us a line on I was going to say Twitter, but X. Anyway, thank you so much to all our listeners, and thank you to Maria, and thank you again to the CIC.